Welcome to the Engineering Influence Podcast, presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies and sponsored by the ACC Retirement Trust. Mergers and acquisitions activity in the engineering industry is at an all-time high, and here on the program to talk with us about it is John Escobar of Morrissey Goodale. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Jerry. Thank you. We at Morrissey Goodale are huge fans of the Engineering Influence Podcast, so pleasure to be here, pleasure to be speaking with you this morning.
Great. Thanks so much. So you gave a presentation at the ACEC Fall Conference and reported that the design services industry has been averaging more than one M&A deal every day, and that you expect the total will top 400 by the end of the year. Could you put that into historical perspective for us and tell us why the market is so active right now?
Absolutely. So the headline of all M&A stats in our industry this year is that deal making is already at record levels. That is what we sit here talking this morning, Jerry, on November 9th, with about 7 weeks left to go in the calendar year. And we've already seen more AE in environmental deals across the U.S., 352 deals as of last Friday this year than any prior year. As an industry, if we look back 10, 12 years ago, the level of deal activity in the space was less than half of where it stands today. To be precise, in 2010, there were 152 deals that were reported in the industry across the domestic United States. That number, with few exceptions, has been increasing fairly linearly year over year to the tune of about 7% compound in annual growth from 2010 to 2020. This year, 2021, as you mentioned, has really been unprecedented in its own right with the activity that we've seen so far, and we're pacing towards 400 deals and activity levels that are expected to be up about 25% over the industry's previous highs. So what's been driving that? Well, there's drivers from the demand side, or what is pushing buyers into the marketplace. We also have drivers from the supply side, or what's pushing sellers into the marketplace. Firstly, from the demand side, the AE industry is a textbook definition of what we call a mature industry. Buyers of AE services are knowledgeable about the services they're purchasing. They're knowledgeable about who the service providers are. There's fairly little, if any, innovation in the space, finite opportunities for organic expansion. And so we don't see the extraordinary growth rates that we see in software, technology, and other emerging and growth industries. As a result, a mature industry is one that is characterized by business failures and business consolidations. Second driver of all this activity is the economy. Deal-making increases in expanding economies as buyers feel confident about the future. Buyers have access to capital, and they use acquisitions as a means to grow and diversify their businesses. So right now, we have households and business balance sheets that are in outstanding shape. We have consumers, investors, and institutions that are sitting on record levels of cash and savings, bolstered by tax credits and stimulus dollars that have flooded the economy over the last 18 months. And GDP is now back above pre-pandemic levels. And the icing on the cake, of course, is that we had Congress pass a $1.2 trillion infrastructure package on Friday, which should further bolster the outlook of the industry. So as the economy has continued to roar over the last several years, we've seen not only the number of deals increase, but the number of active buyers that are entering the market as well. Those are just two from the demand side, two from the supply side, or maybe three from the supply side, Jerry, are what's pushing sellers into the marketplace. First is leadership and ownership transition. We talk a lot about the great resignation in this day and age, but right now we're also seeing the great retirement, with millions and millions of baby boomers leaving the workforce and retiring every week, including firm owners who have the choice at the end of the day to shut off the lights on their business and walk away, to sell the company to their employees, or to look externally for a buyer. Ownership transition is hard for firms to affect. Two-thirds of all small companies are unable to transition ownership beyond their founders, oftentimes resulting in an outside sale. Ownership transition requires patience. It requires exceptional talent and leadership that desires ownership, and it requires capital. Three things that together can be very difficult to come by for many small and lower middle market companies. Further on that, from the supply side, the pandemic has also created a whole bunch of new, highly motivated sellers in the marketplace, firm owners that fought hard to survive the Great Recession, firm owners that navigated the uncharted waters of COVID-19 and have now found their businesses booming. But they're burnt out, they're fatigued, and they're looking to share some of the risk of owning a small, privately held engineering or architecture firm with somebody else. So we've seen a group of sellers, many of which this year are in their mid-40s or mid-50s, with a decade more or more before retirement, that are reprioritizing their personal well-being and reassessing their appetite for risk. And that too has resulted in an uptick in M&A activity. And perhaps the last one and most obvious, Jerry, is we now have Democrats in office, which means that taxes are expected to increase, specifically income and capital gains taxes. So for sellers that are looking to maximize their proceeds from a sale, 2021 very well could be the most favorable economic or tax situation that they see for the next couple of years. And so we've seen a quote unquote rush to the exits, if you will, in 2021 as dealmakers look to lock in the existing rates. And that too has forced several sellers that may have considered a sale in 2022, 2023, or 2024 to expedite those plans, again, as they look to lock in the existing rates.
I was struck by your what you said about the firm leaders who were sort of burnt out by COVID being in their mid-40s or mid-50s. From your experience looking back over the past 10 years, that's an unusual thing, people that young looking to sell, isn't it?
It absolutely is, Jerry. So I think historically M&A, at least within the lower middle market, which we'll classify as firms from $1 million to $150 million of top line revenue, has been viewed as a medium of transition, as a medium and an exit means for firm owners to retire and sunset. This year, you're correct that I think we've seen a much younger group of shareholders, a much younger group of entrepreneurs and owners that are coming to the market, that are reprioritizing their personal well-being, reprioritizing what's important, reassessing their appetite for risk, recognizing that they've fought through a Great Recession, that they've now been through a pandemic, and they don't want to do it again. So we see an increasing number of younger owners that are looking to de-risk themselves, looking to take some chips off the table, and they're looking to sync up with a partner or another industry firm that can help them achieve those goals.
What are the demographics of the firms involved in this? Is there any sort of consistency about, is this like big firms doing this? What are you seeing?
Yeah, this year we've seen action amongst some of the largest firms in the industry, with both Aegon in its sale to New Mountain Capital and Golder in its sale to WSP transacting for enterprise values in excess of $1 billion. But we also continue to see action at the bottom end of the market in terms of size as well. So the interest in exploring M&A on the part of buyers and sellers of all sizes across the industry has been fairly widespread. Is it a big firm trend? For sellers, I think we'll define big firms as those that are greater than $25 million in top line revenue in this industry, or those that we see in the Engineering News-Record top 500 design firms. So looking historically, in any given year, Jerry, we see on average somewhere around 8 of these Engineering News-Record top 500 design firms sell or recapitalize. Looking over the last few years, in 2019, we saw 9 such transactions. During the pandemic year of 2020, when deal activity froze over for several months, this number fell to 5. But year to date, 2021, as of November 9th, this number has jumped to 23. We've seen 23 of the engineering news record top 500 design firms sell already this year. So consolidation amongst the largest firms in the industry is accelerating for some of the same aforementioned drivers that is affecting firms of all size and scale.
What about at the other end of the market, the small firms? How big does a small firm have to be in order to be able to get into this market?
Mm-hmm. So broadly speaking, I'd say, Jerry, that we've been a part of transactions this year with firms that are as small as one employee. The typical AE seller, relatively speaking, is actually quite small. And in fact, from a revenue standpoint, the median seller in our industry has been remarkably consistent over the last 5 years at about $2.5 to $3.5 million of gross revenue. This seller size represents a 10 to 15 person model, one owner, maybe a two owner model, which is the makeup for most of the firms in our industry, proving that M&A is very much a viable way for smaller firms to transition. In 2021, year to date, more than 40% of all deals that we have tracked, of all those 352 US deals, 40% of them have involved a seller with 20 or fewer employees. And given that finding and retaining talent is still one of the biggest challenges amongst firm leaders, we expect to see relatively more deals at this size as firms use M&A as a means of hiring and a means of onboarding quality talent.
Yeah, on that point, is this a case of a small firm owner looking to sell, or a buyer looking to buy and saying, "I'll come and buy you because I want your expertise, I want your people"?
Yeah, so it's been a mix of both. We definitely see firms that are out there that are in this $2.5 to $3.5 million size range that are represented by a Morrissey Goodale or represented by an advisor in the marketplace. But I think a lot of these smaller deals tend to be more opportunistic, tend to be a relationship with a key principal and a principal in another firm. There might be a previous teaming relationship or project relationship with the organization, and perhaps there's a gap in coverage in terms of geographic coverage, market coverage, or a service line that a firm has historically been subbing out to a partner down the road. So a lot of these smaller deals that we see tend to be more relationship based than some of the larger transactions in which buyer and seller have had some prior interaction or some prior relationship prior to the closing of a transaction.
In your program, you mentioned that most of the deals have been interstate with a buyer from one state buying a firm in another. What's the significance of that?
Yeah, so year to date, we find that interstate deal activity accounts for 7 in 10 deals, which again is a record figure. This category of interstate deal making, generally speaks to buyers feeling confident, buyers looking to expand, and buyers using M&A as a growth strategy, and generally willing to pay premiums across state borders to get where they need to go. So interstate deal making refers to a buyer in one state purchasing a seller that is headquartered in another state. This contrasts to intra-state dealmaking, which is something we typically see in downturns or something that we typically see in recessionary environments as firms in the same state and oftentimes in the same cities consolidate as a means of defense or as a means of survival in order to protect market share. So I think the level that we're at in 2021 and the level that we finished 2020 at, which is about 7 in 10 deals, this level of interstate deal making speaks to a market that is strong. It speaks to firm leaders, owners, investors that are bullish on the outlook of the sector and bullish on the outlook of the broader economy. and willing to spend where they need to get to go, which often cases, as we're talking about, refers to purchasing across state lines, many times in higher growth or higher outlook geographic areas.
You mentioned the bullish market. You also mentioned the willing to pay premiums. So I would imagine that valuations in such a market like this are going up. Is that the case?
Definitely. There's been quite a bit of upward pressure on valuations, and we've seen and reported multiples that are really heightened across the board. Part of this, similar to interstate dealmaking, is optimism on the part of buyers. The fact that we are in a very strong economic situation. We have a federal infrastructure stimulus that has been passed that will only serve to bolster that positioning. But part of it too, Jerry, is competition for transaction. There's more buyers in this marketplace than ever before. I'm sure we'll speak somewhat to the influence that private equity has in this place, but there's more buyers in the market than ever before, which has made it very difficult to get access to proprietary deals or deals in which buyer and seller are negotiating with one another and there's no outside competition involved. In this marketplace, sellers have options and many of them are leveraging that to their advantage. And this is especially true in some of the higher growth regions of the country, like the Southeast, like Texas, and like the Mountain West, where there's no shortage of financial and strategic buyers that are looking to grow their presence, to take advantage of some of the demographics and growing outlooks of the economies and the demand for infrastructure services in these states. So really upward pressure across the board in terms of valuation and within some of the geographic markets that we're talking about. In some end markets, such as public infrastructure, which stand to gain the most over the next couple of years, we've seen great demand and we've seen pricing that reflects that demand.
And you mentioned private equity. There's been so much talk about private equity getting into the market. What's their play?
Mm-hmm. So private equity absolutely has entered the industry in a big way over the last decade, to the point where more than one in three of all industry transactions now involves a private equity group or a private equity backed operating firm doing the buying. Equally, 15% of the Engineering News-Record top 100 design firms are now backed by private equity. So private equity, it's not just happening in the AE industry. Private equity's influence in the US has been growing rapidly over the last decade and has become prevalent in almost every sector of the economy, every industry. Mick Morrissey of our firm shared a stat from McKinsey in our latest Word on the Street that indicated private equity's net asset value has grown more than sevenfold since 2002, twice as fast as the global public equities. And the number of US private equity backed companies has simultaneously grown more than 100% since 2006. So there is widespread access to capital. The growth of private equity is influencing not only the AE industry, but all industries in the economy. To the question, Jerry, of what's the play, the private equity model is based on the simple fact that size and scale in a professional services firm translates to higher value. So private equity firms invest in a design or an environmental firm at a certain size and at a specific valuation multiple, and they exit their investment typically after about 5 years, having grown the firm's top line and improved bottom line performance along the way at a higher multiple. So we see a lot of what is referred to as buy and build, in which the private equity firm, the family office firm, acquires a platform, maybe one of those firms in the Engineering News Record top 500 design list, and then looks to rapidly expand by filling in some of the white space in terms of geography, services, and markets via acquisition and via organic growth. And after a certain scale is achieved, after those revenues have doubled, tripled, maybe quadrupled, the intent is then to sell that company most often to another private equity group or a strategic buyer for a greater premium than what it was bought for.
a great acceleration in the market. If you're looking out over the next couple of years, does Morrissey Goodale see that acceleration continuing, or do you see it slowing?
It's a good question, and if I were to pull out crystal ball, Jerry, I'd say in the short term we definitely expect deal activity to continue to increase due to structural factors such as baby boomers retiring, such as challenges tied to leadership and ownership transition, increasing infrastructure spending, and both more private equity transactions as well as more deals used as mass recruitment events. So I think the level of activity that we expect to see in the space, at least over the short term, will continue to increase. And if M&A activity even just continues to increase at the average historical growth rate that we talked at the outset of 7%, we'd expect to see about 430 deals next year. I think with the additive of potential tax changes going into place, with the additive of the infrastructure bill just being passed, we believe we'll see closer to 450 deals in 2022. Amongst those, I think we'll see a different mix of deals. Our predictions at Morrissey Goodale are that about 40% of those transactions will be backed by private equity. We expect that we'll see one or two existing employee-owned or private equity-backed organizations get taken public in 2022. We believe we'll see one publicly traded firm get taken private, similar to New Mountain Capital's taking of Aegon private in 2021. And we think we'll see more non-traditional deals. We think we'll see more investments by AE firms in innovation-driven deals, not those of traditional service lines, but acquisitions by AE firms of data, software, IT, AR, virtual reality firms, as they look to diversify their service lines and move into more of a reoccurring revenue model. And we also think, Jerry, that with the growth projected for the U.S. over the short term, that we believe there will be several new foreign buyers. And we've already seen this demand in our own business, in our own buy-side business, with several new foreign buyers that are looking to penetrate the U.S. market.
We'll have to have you back in a year or so to see how those predictions pan out.
That's absolutely right.
Okay, well, I appreciate you coming on to talk with us.
Thank you, Jerry. Much appreciated. Much appreciated.
So you've been listening to the Engineering Influence podcast presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies and sponsored by the ACEC Retirement Trust. Thanks for listening.